Russ is out of Denver. He works with the some of the most prestigious planners all over the country who look to him and his team. In 1998, we were charging in our Salt Lake City office, Lincoln Financial Advisors, about $5,000 in consulting fees. About 3 years later, we were charging $1 million in consulting fees. Now, not that consulting fees is the goal, because it's not the goal. But when you have an affluent client and you need to speak their language, you need to charge fees because they don't value your work. And there's a lot of work to be done. There's no commission or trials or fees to be paid. So you need to do the right thing. And so we talk about going up into a helicopter, so to speak, and taking the large view and looking at everything from a legal, and not just from a legal basis or a tax basis or an investment basis or an insurance basis, but across the board. And on a cross-disciplinary basis, do what's right and come back to our clients and show them the gaps. And these gaps are profound in estate tax, in income tax, in investment management and risk management. And we went from, in about 3 or 4 years, to $1 billion under management. Tremendous amount of GDC target premium as a result of Russ Jones. But we learned how to speak the language of the affluent. And so I'm grateful and privileged to be here to speak to Russ. Not all of us in this room are going to probably relate to what some of the things he's going to say or is going to go out and do what Russ is going to share with us. But if you have an affluent client and you want to know how to really help them and that family, then this is something that you'll appreciate. So with that, here's Russ Jones.
Well, I hope I can live up to the introduction. Thank you, Stowen. And I'm hopeful that I have some important things, useful things that you can take away from this session. I frankly feel as if I don't do that, it will have been a waste of your time, frankly, a waste of my time to travel over here. So, you know, and if that happens very often, I'm going to be shouting more and wearing this less. There are a few things I would like to encourage you to do over the next 50 minutes that I have. And the first is let in everything that I'm going to say. Right? I'm not going to taint you. I'm not going to freak you out. I'm going to be in your face a little bit. I'm hopefully not going to be offensive, but I'd like to encourage you to let in everything that I'm going to say. If an hour after I'm done or 3 days after I'm done, you want to throw some of this away, go ahead. But please don't filter it out before you've had a chance to process it and let it percolate around a little bit. The next thing I want to talk about is this little awesome chart that I did just hours ago. Pretty neat, huh? It's an X and Y axis for those of you that can't see it, and the bottom axis is time. And this is just a number of people that are currently in our industry. Life insurance, financial planners, investment guys, bank officers that are doing this kind of stuff. That number, if you go from the 70s to today, has dropped significantly. The little dotted line underneath it is the amount of training that's being given. Our company went from this much training, cut 90% of its budget, and has this much training. And I imagine that 95% of the people in this room have that same experience with their companies. There aren't very many people that we're competing against, said another way, and those that we are competing against aren't particularly well trained. They don't know their business. They don't know their craft. What's the key piece to this, in my estimation? Somebody tell me the number of people that are worth $1 million or $10 million or $50 million now versus 1970. When I first went in to see somebody in 1980 that was worth $1 million, I was thinking I need a set of Depends before I walked in. I thought for sure that, and it was an anomaly to meet somebody that was worth $1 million or had $1 million of investable. Today, that happens frequently. In between these two areas here, between a drop in the number of people and the drop in the training and the market that's out there, this is all opportunity, right? We all have this opportunity. There's a market that's not being served. They don't have the expertise to serve it. There aren't people to serve it. And those people that can serve it are in this room. The next question then is, what does this serve thing look like? And that's my primary topic for this morning. I had a trouble coming up with the title itself. The first one, you know, A Great Reawakening, Redefining Service and Duty in the High Net Worth Marketplace. How many of you, when you see that title, are looking for a pillow? Okay, that sounds great, Russ. So I thought, well, maybe another title would be Hired in the High Net Worth Marketplace. That's kind of exciting. And then some of you might be going, well, I don't really work in the high net worth marketplace, or I only work there occasionally. And my points today will be applicable to every market. If you're working with teachers' annuities or nurses in hospitals or people that are about to retire and roll their $100,000 or $500,000 IRA into some kind of investment with you, everything that I'm going to be speaking about is as applicable there as it is in a $50 million marketplace. So this is part of, I want you to let in what I want to go over so that you can take your practice to that next level regardless of marketplace. Said I had trouble coming up with a title. Here was my third. I think some of you in here might be LDS. I'm not, but I love that. I love the relationships I have with friends that are. One of the programs that's out right now is this Duty to God. And I'm on thin ice when I speak about the duty to God. In our office, two of my people that I hired originally, I said, tell me about this duty to God. Why is it different than the program that was similarly named and everything from 3 or 4 years ago? He said, well, instead of just going and checking the boxes and at the end of the day saying, hey, I did all 12 things and woohoo, I'm a guy that did the duty to God, that the challenge was to internalize it, to make it more alive and more real. Part of that was to behold, thou art my son and I have work for thee. To my way of thinking, work is being of service. Charlene, a few minutes ago, said, hey, it has been great to serve you over the last year. Well, guess what? That was work. These guys getting together on committees, figuring out how the speakers are, organizing this kind of a thing. There's a lot of work involved in that, in being of service to you. My belief, my conviction about service to our marketplace has never been stronger. The need has never been greater. The urgency with which we need to serve our market has never been more apparent to me. And so what is it that I hope to accomplish today? How are you differentiating yourself in your market? And I don't care what that market is. How are you different than the guy that was in the door a week earlier? Or one of the hundreds of people that have been in that door over the last several years? What's the value of your knowledge, wisdom, and experience? Isn't that what you're bringing to the market? Isn't that what your clients or prospective clients are hoping to see? Is where? How are you going to be different than something you could get on a website? Right. If I'm looking for retirement income, how many websites can you go to right now and in 5 minutes tell me what your retirement number is, my ING, carry it around at the bus stop number? You can go to hundreds. And in 5 minutes, put in, I want to retire at age 65. I want $100,000 a year, 3% inflation rate, 7% rate of return, compute. Your number is X. How are you different than that? What makes you different? Is it because you have a NAVA plan that does the same thing? Is it because you've got some computer model that's nifty and greater? I don't think so. I think the thing that makes you different is the exercising of your knowledge, wisdom, and experience in your marketplace. That's what people are counting on. And when you deliver knowledge, wisdom, and experience, that's service. It's the opportunity for service, I should say. So that's the thing I want to explore together this morning. What's your system, process, procedure, and how-to manual for working in your marketplace? Are you conscious, competent about what you're delivering in your marketplace? And I'll explore that a little bit more Stefan, this should bring back evil memories from the past. The next piece, in regards to insurance investments, what's your duty and what's your burdensome responsibility to deliver to your clients? Now, those words to me seem A, abstract, and my job today is to make them not abstract, but personal and applicable immediately. How is it that something can be a duty and a burdensome responsibility? Frankly, I didn't feel this way for the first 20 years of my career, but I feel passionate about it now. It goes back to, there's work to be done, son. I'm expecting you to do that work, and that's called service. So, value in delivering your service to your marketplace. Okay, what's service? Service is more than filling out the right forms, doing your quarterly reports, answering the phone calls on time, knowing what you're talking about. Those are all prerequisites for providing service to our marketplace. I pay $4 million to the IRS. Are you kidding me? That's the best plan I could come up with? This person's a mess. Every one of them. They don't know it. It's not their fault. Some strong person, me and you, is going to show them the light. That was the words that I learned 30 years ago. Is going to show them the light. And with every decent thing in us, insist, persist, and persuade them to put their problems in our hands. We owe them that. They believe that. It's implied in our promise, our commitment to work with them. I just don't think we recognize it sometimes. It's like we forget. We walk out of church and we forget 10 minutes later. I'm hopeful that I can find the clicker and figure out what I have on the next slide. Okay, so how do I do that? I get it. I need to be of service. This person's a mess. How do I do that in a way that differentiates me from everybody? And with all due respect to our speaker yesterday, I don't think it's saying, do you have a plan? I think it's showing them, right then and there, first time we get together, the difference between what they have and what they could have. $500,000 market, $5 million market, $35 million market, same story. I'll lace some stories, real case stories in. Can you all hear me okay, by the way? Okay, good. You think I'm going to be able to scream this loud all day? Probably not. So, what is it that people that are conscious, competent, that are professionals in our business do? Well, they do the same thing as professionals in any line of business. They know what they're going to do and say before they say and do it. Do you. Every time. Do you know what you're going to do in this meeting? It's the first time I'm meeting a client. Do I know what I'm going to do and say, how I'm going to do and say it before I say it? Am I conscious, competent about how I'm going to take this person I've never met before? By the way, best meeting we have, isn't it? The most fun you can have in our business is taking that person and slingshotting them from who the heck's in the lobby, Russ who? How do I get them out of here as soon as possible? How do I take it from that to, oh my gosh, I didn't realize I have those problems. You can help me. Yes, I'll get together with you. Can you do that in 30 or 45 minutes? What's better? How fun is that? Well, the only way you can do it is that conscious competent. I know what I'm going to do and say, how I'm going to do it and say it, why I'm going to do it and say it before I do it. What about the other alternative? How is it that many of us, and frequently human nature encourages us, how is it that many of us operate our business? I'm a great communicator. That's what we think. I'm good on my feet. I'm a natural sales guy. I got the gift of gab. My little point under there, oh, I don't have it on this slide. I think I changed it because I knew that it was an LDS crowd. I'm a pretty religious guy myself. What I have under here usually is we smoke our own dope.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it? Don't we? I want to believe that I'm a good communicator. I want to believe that it's okay that I don't have this conscious, competent,
thing that I'm going to have memorized and canned in my head, because nobody wants to can in our head anything. I want to justify it. But the truth is, that's what chumps do. It's what chumps do. If we do it, we're a chump. Why? Because any other field of endeavor, people that are best at their game, don't do that, do they? Peyton Manning lost the game last weekend against the Atlanta Falcons for Denver. Threw three interceptions and a fumble in the first quarter. Hard to win. Reminded me of BYU last night, by the way. A horrible game. What did he do when he came off the field? He said, I learned a lot. Peyton Manning is one of those guys that works harder than anybody else on the team. Knows where every play is. Watches every person on the field. One of the best in the league. Certainly when he retires, no question, going to the Hall of Fame. In his field, his area of expertise, one of the best. You ever seen a playbook for the NFL? We do some work with the New York Jets and the Philadelphia Eagles. The playbook is that thick. There's two plays on each page. What is it that Peyton Manning does when he's at the line of scrimmage or those rare times when he has a huddle with the guys around? What is he doing? Calling a play. A canned play. Hey, wait, I'm the best in the world. I can see the field like nobody else. My arm is like a rocket. I'm best in breed. He's calling a play, a canned play? Seriously? But we think we don't have to call canned plays. That we don't have to know what we're going to do and say before we do and say it. Peyton Manning does, right? Why? Guys on the other side of the ball are pretty good. The client, the prospect, your ideal client, your hoped-for new client has had dozens of people approach them over the years. What's going to differentiate you is that you got that playbook. You know what you're going to do and say before you do and say it. Where is that for you? Where's that script for you? By the way, there's hundreds of examples. People that are actors, Shakespeare, Hamlet, to be or not to be, whether it is nobler to suffer the... If the guy got up and went, hey, you know, I got a question. I'm not sure whether this is the best course of action or that's the best course of action. I'm really confused about this whole thing. You're in a Shakespeare play. What are you thinking of the actor that's ad-libbing and saying, well, I got the concept of... You're saying you're a chump, aren't you? It's not what a pro does. A pro knows their lines. The challenge is to make them their own, to make that act come alive. Your act in front of your prospect, your client, is it a conscious, competent act? Do you know exactly, not sort of, exactly? Bob, most business owners never had their estate settlement costs calculated. They're unaware of what these costs are, the impact on their estate, their business, and their family. But what we're going to do is identify those costs, look at ways to reduce or eliminate those costs, and how to best pay the unavoidable cost in your situation. Does that sound scripted? Yeah. Why? Because I was going through it at like a 45 instead of a 33. But I can tell you that in front of a client, me taking the necessary pauses, me doing the act, that's how I say it every time. Stefan, you've heard me talk about the estate taxes. So here's your estate, X, it's gonna grow to 2X. Your estate taxes 10 years from now will be 100% of your current net worth today. John, when I say that, it's not important that we recognize it. What's important is how you feel about it. Is that two thumbs up? One thumb up, one thumb down, two thumbs down. Hell no, that's not going to happen here. You spent 70 years becoming worth $10 million. And in the next 10 years, you're going to voluntarily give what you spent 70 years to build to the IRS. That's the best we can come up with. Conscious competence. What am I going to do and say? How am I going to do it and say it before I say it? That's what professional delivery of service looks like in that example. By the way, did you say I had 3 hours, John? Or was it? Yeah. That's what I'd like to spend. So what I want to do first is this whole Michael Jackson imitation about the man in the mirror. And I'm just going to do it like without the body or the singing. So let's take a look in the mirror on our own practice. In our process, we have a three-step process to get a new client. And some of you would have a two-step, I would argue. I don't think anybody would have a one-step or a no-step. But a three-step for us would be, how am I getting introduced to that person? When I first see them, how is it that I'm discussing what it is that we do and what services we provide, how we might be of value to them? And for us in the high net worth marketplace, that's a traction meeting. It's specific. How much are you worth? How is it titled? How much debt do you have? Tell me about your will and trust. Tell me about your buy-sell agreement. That's that first meeting. But generally, we're not good enough in that first meeting to say 10 to 20 basis points of a person's net worth exclusive of their life insurance. In your case, it looks like your net worth is about X, $12 million. The fee would then be someplace between $12,000 and $24,000 based on complexity. Looking at the complexity of your estate, it looks like you're going to be in the lower half of that, but we're not making that decision today. Does that sound scripted too? Yes. Have I said it 100 times in front of high net worth clients as the way that we're paid, one of the three ways? Yes. Am I getting the information from them so that I can go back to my office, not have the real bullets of an initial meeting with a high net worth person going by my ears? Can I debrief the documents? Can I look for the weaknesses between the coordination of the titling of their assets, their wills and trusts, the beneficiary designations? Yes, 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 yes. I can do it in my office, and now I can kind of load my gun. Now I can have my executive summary where I come back with bullet points that are going to disturb that person. Someone had it up on their slides yesterday, and they quoted, I want to say it was a Ben Feldman, I'm not sure, it was, problems, 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 show them the problems. That was one of the quotes. One of the slides up there that Anthony had said, disturb. Disturb is not something that most humans feel comfortable with. It's like, I'm going to go in and disturb somebody? That's going to be how they're going to get motivated to work with me? That just sounds counterintuitive. But the truth is, what disturbing means is showing them the difference between what they have and what they could have. That's disturbing. I've worked with my attorney for 20 years. He never told me that. That's disturbing. My retirement is X, I need Y. That's disturbing. That's a problem. And I'm a solution to those problems. And I'm a professional. You can hear that I've gone through it hundreds of times. I'm not making it up on the spot. I'm not just good on my feet. So this is the little self-assessment grading grid. I'd like you to pull out a piece of paper and grade yourself. I'm going to give you a little coaching on what each of these mean. So this first one, your introduction process, what does it look like? Specifically, what's your system, process, procedure in your practice? What's your how-to manual in your practice that gets you introductions to new clients in your target market? Specifically, what are you using to filter out those you don't want? Is there a conscious competency to it? As an example, in our initial meeting with a client, we tell them we get paid in three ways. I just went through the fee one a minute ago. I tell them that we're an open architecture firm. We represent them in the financial marketplace. Regardless of the name of the company that's providing the financial product, our job is to be your representative in the marketplace, scour that marketplace for the product that best meets your needs. The third way is your active goodwill in introducing us to other business owners or executives who have been exposed to this service, but probably just like you, don't know what they don't know. Typically, if we've done a job better than anyone else that you've ever worked with, a good client of ours will recommend us to 10 or 15 people just like themselves, successful business owners. And I'll describe that to them. $10 million and above net worth, they care for their family, they got a great business, whatever. On your conscious competency introduction process, how is that built into your business model? If I went to one of your assistants and said, hey, tell me about John's introduction process, would they go, I don't know what you're talking about? Or, yeah, he does get introduced. I have no idea how he does it. We do get some referrals every now and then. Where's the conscious competent piece to it? Grade yourself. Is it an A, a B, or a C? The second piece, this initial meeting, same story, different chapter. What is it that you're doing in your initial meeting? First time I ever met with them. How are you differentiating yourself right then, real time, real bullets? Right? What is it that's different than the guy that came in from one of your competitors the week before or a week after you? And grade yourself. This engagement proposal piece, same story. By the way, there's the handouts that if you didn't get one, you can grab on your way out. But I have a sample engagement proposal in there. And I'll go through that in a little bit more detail this afternoon session. And I'll touch on it here as we go through some things here this morning as well. So here's the reason this is important. If you have a great introduction, Colin Powell just introduced me to the new Joint Chief of Staff head. Okay, I think there's probably a pretty good chance that that guy will take the appointment with me. That's a great introduction. But if I go in there and step on my toes the entire time, I do a C job on my initial meeting with the client, what do you think that Joint Chief of Staff guy is going to think? Why did Colin send him over to me? This guy's a yahoo. I did a lousy job on my second meeting. But I came back with my engagement proposal. I did okay. Maybe my chances are 50-50 of picking up a new client. If I had an okay introduction, not somebody I met at the bus stop, but somebody that had actually done our product and services, and then I get a bang-up first meeting and a bang-up engagement proposal, now I probably have an 85 or 90% chance of picking up a new client. The same thing could be said if I have a lousy introduction, an average initial meeting, and a poor engagement proposal. Maybe I can pick up 20 or 25%. My point in doing this is to do this self-reflective look in the mirror. Where am I on the conscious competency of what I'm delivering in my marketplace? So, where's your business plan for the balance of this year? Can you put down on the piece of paper that you have in front of you, I need to work on part one, part two, or part three, the initial introduction, my interview, my initial interview, or my engagement proposal. Can I build something between now and October 1st in the weak areas that I have to get conscious competent about it, to build a process in my business so that it is improved dramatically? When can I get that done by? Oops. When can I get that done by? So a couple of key pieces to it. An engagement proposal. That again, there's samples of it in there, and that's a cheat sheet version of it. In other words, it has notes for the advisor on what they would say to the client because they might forget. But generally speaking, what the client gets is notes, very cryptic notes, that they don't necessarily understand any of. An engagement proposal is a presentation. A presentation is a series of notes that lead to a sale. It's not a book. It's not a story. A 30-page document does not sell anything. A series of notes, a bullet point. Here's an example. LPOA. If I say that on a piece of paper with a little hash mark beside it, how many of you know what that means? So like four. How many of your, six. How many of your clients would know what LPOA means? Okay, it means limited power of appointment. If I have that down there, I got a whole litany of discussion points with them. But to them, unless they have me as the key to that map, it's nonsense. It means nothing. But that's what a presentation is. If I put LPOA and then I have two paragraphs describing what a limited power of appointment means in a document and why it's important, and your document distributes things 50% to your son, 50% to your daughter, and what if your wife and you are not here and that 50% that's going to your son and he and his wife have a Down syndrome child, severely, and that Down syndrome child is going to need lifetime care and assistance, would you still divide your estate 50-50? Is there a chance you'd like the flexibility, the option, maybe 60-40 or 70-30? Your document doesn't allow that. We had a situation in Denver. four kids, where the distribution was equal to the four kids, and one of them became a drug addict. He ended up dying in a Marriott hotel room in Denver of a drug overdose. Did you want to really give that person irrevocably in the document $5 million of cash? Wouldn't that be the worst thing you could do? But your document requires it. Were they aware of that? Was that an objective before I came into that meeting? Oh, limited power of appointment. By the way, one reason I want to work with you, Russ, I need limited powers of appointment in my documents. Has anybody ever said that to me? No. So a series of notes leading to a sale, and an executive summary. It shouldn't be any more than two or three pages, maybe five. Now, maybe I've done a bunch of analysis on the wills and trusts. Maybe I have spreadsheets. Maybe I've got 30-year cash flow projections. I got a ton of other work I've done. But what that person's getting, two or three pages, bullet points. Each bullet point justifies my fee. I do two bullet points, an LPOA and something else, and a fire alarm rings, and before we run out the door, I go, are we on or are we off? And he says, we're on, because those two bullet points, each one of them was worth the $7,500 fee you quoted. That's how it gets onto the executive summary. It passes that litmus test. Do you have an engagement proposal, a process that you go through like that, that increases your likelihood of success? Nothing guarantees it, but I can stack the deck. I'm gonna be way behind if I don't shut up. this we're gonna spend time on this afternoon. This is our family legacy pyramid. Steal it, use it, change the colors, change the name on it. I don't have any copyrights on it, I don't care. But in our planning, it's a North Star. Every client that we work with, we do a family legacy pyramid like identical. This is it. And every client, regardless of market, is concerned about this. Why? Because they don't know that they're okay. There has never, somebody, one of the speakers said, never been a better time to be in our business. Why? The market's never been freaked out like this. I don't mean the stock market, I mean our target market has never been freaked out like this. You're freaked out about it. How many of you are concerned about your own retirement planning? How many of you liked the last 12 years return that you got on the S&P 500 and thought, whew, if I can keep this up for another 12, I can punch my clock and start taking my money? The answer is nobody. Everybody in our market. We have a beverage distributor down in Louisiana, $35 million net worth. Takes $2.1 million to support he and his third wife. He makes 2.4. When I first walked in, 35 million, oh my gosh, they've got eight kids total, four from his two first marriages, four from hers. I thought, wow, this guy needs to start moving money out of his taxable estate, getting it into stuff for the kids and the grandkids, because he's only in his 60s and 35 million is gonna be worth 100 million before you know it. Guess what? Can't afford to move anything over. You're spending 2.1, making 2.4. 2.4 after pre-tax, after tax, maybe you're making 1.7, 1.8, but you're blowing through 2.1, you're going through $300,000 or $400,000 a year. Your business is illiquid, it's 25 out of your 35 million. The place in Tahoe, 7.4 million. You don't have enough money, you're not okay. At $35 million, most of us would say, he's okay. I'd be okay if I had $35 million. But the truth is, he's not okay. No portion of your marketplace is confident that they're okay. I'm gonna make, before we're done, you less confident about your own situation and your client's situation than you were 40 minutes ago. How's that for an objective? That's disturbing. That's where value is. That's where service is between what I have and what I don't have. You can be the savior between those two for them. So I'm going to go over this in my afternoon session and how to use that and the specifics on it. Every one of those bullet points down there that to you might look mundane needs to have something that makes it burst off the page, makes it come alive. Property and casualty insurance. Okay, right. I double dare you. Property and casualty. You're going to make that come alive off the page. I don't even offer property and casualty insurance. I don't. We don't. Lincoln doesn't. We're prohibited from doing it. Why is it on my sheet of are we okay? Because Diana Parker, one of our prestige planners that Stefan knows, had a client where his son had a drug and alcohol abuse problem, had gone to a rehab facility, had a couple of DUIs, and at 4:30 in the morning, driving home in a company car, ran into the back of a sandwich maker truck, a work site sandwich truck, severed the operator's legs. True story. Dad's worth $50 million. The property and casualty insurance had a clause, as most of them do, that on the company car, you can't drive it if you have DUIs and drug and alcohol history. But the son was driving. So when the claim came in about the operator that had lost his legs, what do you think the insurance company did? That's your problem. What was that problem? It was an $8 million settlement. Do you think that left a mark on somebody worth $50 million? Do you think that's a risk to them being okay? Can you see how something as mundane as property and casualty insurance is a risk to them being okay, and how having a story makes it come alive? Where's yours? And again, there's no magic to this thing that we came up with. Steal it, use it, modify it. There's abbreviations on here too, look at that. This is how I stay in control of this meeting. Are some of you, I saw somebody taking a picture or a couple pictures with their iPhone. When you get back to your office, what are you going to do with this bottom line here?
What does that mean?
DLC, financial management. What are you going to do with that?
You say that jerk didn't talk about it.
Or you might say, that was a great example of a series of notes that I understand that you don't. I, the presenter, you, the client, don't. And you need me as the key to that map.
It means divorce, liability, creditors, financial mismanagement, federal estate tax, generation skipping tax.
Now, how do I make those things come alive as opposed to some genericized, irrelevant piece? Again, I'll go over this in much more detail this afternoon. Okay, family income, retirement income, that's the bottom of that part of the pyramid. See right in the middle where it says asset protection, investment rate of return, inflation, down here at the bottom, standard of living, inflation, blah, blah.
I want to focus on that for a second. Our job as planners, as insurance or investment people, is to be able to make everything on this come alive.
But I'm just going to focus on this because we only have a certain amount of time. So let's look at this for a second. There's four variables on the bottom of that pyramid that all of us put into every one of our models. Isn't that true? Here's what those four variables are: your standard of living, your life expectancy, inflation, and your rate of return. Does that go in any of the models that you do for somebody's retirement income or financial independence models? Do any of you do retirement or family income kind of planning and try and use those variables?
Yes, okay, good. So what's the difference between you and that Vanguard site I mentioned a moment ago?
Can't you go on to Vanguard and get the answer to those four variables? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yeah. That's the natural answer. What's the right answer? No. Why? Your knowledge, wisdom, and experience. The client needs you to put context on those four variables. Without it, they're lost. They're trusting you to do that. We're on autopilot about the Vanguard website. What I'm asking us to do is be of service to our clients by giving context to those four variables. So let's look at them for a minute. And we're going to, you think I'm going kind of fast? We're going to really, really go fast. So if I make a mistake on any of those four variables, and we get into the middle of retirement, so as an example, let's say that somebody retired 12 years ago. The S&P 500 over that 12-year period has delivered a negative real rate of return of minus 15%. Now, notice the real is the caveat in there, okay? The nominal rate of return has been 1 or 2% positive. But the real purchasing power, the real rate of return for that first 12 years of retirement is minus 15. How many of your models had that built in?
Hey, the first 12 years of your retirement, we're going to put 40% in fixed income, and 60% we're going to put into some type of market-sensitive investment. And you know, historically, that's gotten 10.26% over the last 50 years of the S&P 500, and we're just expecting we can mimic those kind of results over the first 12 years of your retirement. And now what? Now I'm 12 years into it. I'm negative 15. Can you make that up as a 72-year-old, a 75-year-old, an 80-year-old? Show me your model that's going to make that kind of a loss up. So what's the consequence if my model is off? If the Vanguard I plugged and played is off? The consequence is catastrophic for that person. What differentiates us is making those four variables have the shock absorbers and buffers around them to absorb those kinds of differences in the marketplace. So let's look at them for a few seconds. Standard of living. How many of the models that you put together put in a change in the marginal tax rate for your upper affluent clients going from 35 to 45 at the margin next year or the following year? Okay, I said that the objective was $100,000 a year net spendable. Maybe this year I need 120. How many of your models plug in I need 130 next year? Right, I've got my 35% rate. I've got my Bush tax cuts that are planned to expire. That brings me to 40, give or take. I plug in a little Obama health care, a little Medicare increase for my unearned income. I'm at 45. 10 points on 35 points, I have a 30 or 35% increase at the margin on my taxes. Does your model show that? Does the Vanguard model take that into account when it says, how much do you need to live on every month? Can you differentiate yourself in every market by having that portion of a discussion with a client? Yes. Yes, you absolutely can. So the better safe than sorry. If I make a big mistake, I live under a viaduct on that example. If I make a little mistake, Rush, you got an extra $1 million. You and Susan, your wife, you can live on that. You could give it to the kids. You could find a charity or give it to your school. That's a little mistake. I had extra money. Big mistake. Ran out of money at 85, living under a viaduct. Big mistake. Where's your context to your clients on the standard of living net piece of the discussion? Are we taking it at face value? How much do you need? I need 100. Really? Is it 120? Is it 80? Are you diving into that with them? Are you being of service to them by taking at face value what they say? I'm not saying they're lying. They don't know what they don't know. So the second one, life expectancy. This is great. Many of the models that I see are showing an age 85 life expectancy. You go, oh, none of my models would do that. Life expectancy might be 87 for a guy. What I'm suggesting is that you have to run it to at least age 95. It's the big mistake, little mistake thing again. Hey, I died at 87. We had an extra couple $1 million. Woohoo! You didn't run out of money. You could give it to your kids, charity, what have you. That's good news, not bad news. By the way, this is true both on the retirement income and on the survivor kind of family income scenarios. Inflation. And these are in, their quotes are in this handouts that you have. John Williams, economist, Dartmouth grad, Tuck School business grad, headline inflation, what we read in the paper, 2 to 3%. What we don't know, what your clients don't know, where you can differentiate yourself is to not smoke that dope. You tell me, looking in the rearview mirror, with the exception of your flat screen or your computer, tell me something that's grown by 2 or 3% over the last decade. Was it the gas in your car? Your kids' education, that was it. No, your medical expenses. I'll bet you the food that you bought. Tell me something. I mean, Even my house has grown more than that, and we've had the worst housing crisis, I'm talking about a decade-long period, worst housing crisis in our history, and it's grown at more than 2 or 3%. We're going to build a model that says, yeah, inflation forever, 2 or 3%. You got a 30-year model until you die at age 95. Do you know how inflation was calculated or is? Study it. Look into it. Here's how it was calculated when I got done college. In the 80s, here's how it was calculated. Basket of goods and services, 2011. Basket of goods and services, 2012. Difference in price, inflation. How many of you think that sounds logical or reasonable? Every one of us do. When somebody says, I want to retire on 100 grand a year, that's their definition. It is. They aren't thinking, well, we spent 100 grand on this and that, and that allowed us to go to St. Thomas on vacation, but we're going to substitute out our standard of living, and we're going to start going to Tampa instead of going to St. Thomas. And we're not going to go out to, what was the name of the restaurant last night, John?
Chef's Table.
Chef's Table. We're going to start going out to the Outback Steakhouse. We're not going to go and buy the new Mercedes. We're going to buy a Buick. When you look at the 2 or 3% inflation, the biggest thing that's changed since that definition that I gave you is that the methodology used to calculate it assumes substitution because no one could absorb a real increase in the cost of goods and services at what it was last year of 9%. Do your model. Imagine your model with a 600 basis point difference between 3% in the model and 9% that happened last year. Now, some of you are going, yeah, but when you get older, you don't travel as much. And you know, that kind of stuff, and you need to change your model. This doesn't have anything to do with that. This is just the cost of goods and services year over year. I'm not suggesting that you put 9% in your models, but I'm really not suggesting you keep 3% and saying the person's safe. They're good to go. Nothing to worry about here. 3, gotcha. You can't print $40 billion a month indefinitely and say you're good on the inflation front. That will come back to haunt you. Okay, so the rate of return. So we talked about a buffer around your life expectancy. Don't put it in at age 85, make it at least age 95. We put in not just that, but for your standard of living. I don't want to put in just the raw number. I want to make sure I've got a hedge. I've got some protection in the event that things change. We just talked about the inflation rate. What about the rate of return? And again, the sources for all of this are in the handouts for you, so you can read them. But a compilation from Jeremy Grantham, considered one of the best 100 money managers of the last century. John Hussman, $10 billion under management, brilliant guy out of California. The Hussman funds, 4 of them, $10 billion. Bill Gross, PIMCO. These are the sources for this stuff that we're looking at here. Do your clients know that? Are we building a model that says 7% expected rate of return over the next 30 years, 3% inflation, live to age 85, and you need 100 grand, forget the taxes, and thinking they're okay? Let's look at the consequences of some of those pieces. This is my 401k statement that came out in July 6th, right? Notice what it says. Russ, $7,629 is your monthly income at retirement, and when you retire, you're going to have $1.26 million. And I can't believe I can't see it up on the screen. Here's what the assumptions are. If you work to, and it says right down at the bottom, this is the whole reason I put the darn thing on there, but what it says is that if you continue to put away money at the same rate you're putting away until age 65, 8 years, and then you retire, assuming you earn 6% between now and then, and you retire at 4 or 5% rate of return, you'll be able to take this amount of money out till age 85. Let me go over that again. 6% between now and retirement, putting the same number away, 5% after retirement, and you can take out $7,600 through age 85. What does it say about when I'm 86? No guarantee. Do you remember that expression when you're like when I was younger? Oh, they got 86. Where did that come from? What if it meant they kind of lost their they got 86. They got cut. They were done. At 86 in this model, I'm done. Right? This isn't a service to me. This is what you get on the website where you plug and play and you get your number that you can cart into the bus stop with you. So here's an example. Jim and Julie are actually clients of mine that I met with on Tuesday. That's not their age. They're 48 and 56. They sold their business 5 years ago and they have about $7.5 million investable, $2 or $2.5 million of other assets, about a $10 million net worth, and they need $200,000 a year net spendable. That's their real case story. This is what I just used to kind of steal from. Jim and Julie are 65 couple. They need 100 grand for 30 years, so that puts them at age 95. They got $3 million investable, two on a qualified plan, 28 blended tax rate, Fed, state, capital gains. Inflation, 3, 5, and 7. I'm building a grid. What are my rates of return? Well, after taxes and after expenses, somebody show me somebody after tax, after expense, getting 7.5. My mother comes and speaks with me. And in her CDs that she had from 5 years or so ago that were at 4.5 or 5%, what's she renewing those at today? 0.0 or 0.1 or 0.2 or 0.5? So if she was getting 50 grand a year, she's getting 5. But people say that the drop in interest rate, the drop in the crediting rate, the low Fed borrowing rate is screwing our retired people that are dependent on safe sources of income. This is what it means. My mother. So I'm building a grid. Excuse me. I'm building a grid with a 4.5, 5.5, and 6% after expenses, meaning from the investment themselves, and after taxes. Can I get those? No small feat right now. If someone can give me 6.5%, lock me in, I'm all over it. So what this grid shows is down the left-hand margin here is the rate of inflation, 7, 5, and 3. Across the top, my rates of return. And this would be the deficit. So if I got 4.5% rate of return, 7% inflation, I'd be short, meaning my $3 million, right? $2 million qualified, $1 million unqualified. My $3 million would be short $3.4 million of giving me the 100 grand a year. Said another way, if instead of 100 grand a year, I could take out 48,750, but I'm thinking I can retire on 100 grand. Am I disturbed? This guy sold his business. He's retired now. He went and started a wine connections business, distributing wine because he loved wine. And he lost $700,000 or $800,000 doing it. He doesn't want to go back to work. Is that disturbing when somebody says, hey, you may not want to, but you're short by $52,000 a year? Oh, okay, well, Russ, that's too pessimistic, 7% inflation. What if it was 5 and I had my 5.5% rate of return, net of all expenses, net of my taxes? So what is that grossed up to? Well, most of us would say, well, there's at least 1 or 1.5% in our asset management fees, right? And then if I added my taxes back on top of it, so I went from 5.5 to 7 just on my fees, maybe I'm going to 9 to net down to my 5.5. That's aggressive in my view. But at 5.5 and a 5% inflation, I can have 80 grand a year, or I'm just short $762,000 on a present value basis. Can you see how I get to have a meaningful conversation with this client now? I'm not smoking the dope that's on the website. I'm giving them context to each of these four variables. And it wasn't a pleasant conversation, but it was necessary. It was valuable. It was being of service to them. So the difference between these two, here's what they would have gotten on their website. Hey, I put in 6.5, my 3% headline inflation number. Hey, I'm overfunded by 675 grand. Woohoo, honey. Let's get some champagne. I'm suggesting that the difference between being overfunded and maybe more realistically funded, and I still think that's somewhat aggressive, that's $1.5 million on $3 million. That's a 50% difference just by the assumptions that I'm using. What assumptions are you using? By the way, can you see how this would be different than the guy that came in the door before you? By the way, does that seem like it would be true in a $5 million market or a $50 million market as well? It is. Okay. Bad news. Jim and Julie. Jim, in my office on Tuesday. Now, this conversation is from probably 2 months ago. You're underfunded. And he's like, but I thought at $3 million, and again, they really have 7.5, but at 7.5 for them, $3 million, I'm overfunded. I thought I was part of the 1% that did have enough money. And I could have folded then and gone, you know, yeah, you're probably right. We probably just need to assume the 7.5 and the 3, and you're good. You made 450 point spread, and you're good, and you're good, and it's good. But I wouldn't be a value to or service to them. I'd be buying their stuff. I'd be a disservice to them. They may not figure that out for 10 or 20 years that I was a disservice. But to me, that's tragic. To me, I've let them down. I've betrayed their trust. Earning their trust is what I'd like to do. So you have options. Do you want to know what I told them? Jim, here's the best advice that I can give you. You need to go back to work for at least 5 years and make at least 100 grand a year. That, honest to God, is what I told them. And he was pushing back. What if we had $200,000 a year? We did that for 10 years. And then the next 10 years, or the next 20 years, then we would just kind of knock that back down to, you know, like 150 or something. I said, Jim, the number you'd have to knock it back down to is like 92. He's like, oh, yeah, but I mean, but we'd be fine for a pretty long time. And I went, yes, you would be. Here's how it would work out. Remember what I said earlier? She's 47, he's 56, or she's 48, he's 56. You're right, Jim, you would be fine. And Julie is sitting right there. It's Julie that would be living under the viaduct. And by the way, you can say anything with a smile on your face. And I did. But they got the message. Our job is to deliver that message and help them figure out how to get past it. You know, I can monkey with the numbers. You guys know all these other pieces, I think, right? You can reduce the money you're spending ASAP, in other words, live within your budget. The first response, what if we do this? So I'm going to skip through that. So, conclusions. I should have paused now because I'm going to be done in a second. Conclusions. Service means, A, being a professional. A professional knows what they're going to do and say, how they're going to do and say it before they do it. That's what a professional does. So let's get conscious competent in each of these three areas, getting started with our new client relationship. The introduction, the initial interview, that engagement proposal, if you go through that, let's get professional. Service involves speaking the truth with compassion, with expertise, with knowledge, wisdom, with your experience. I'm not leaving them out there to dry. I'm trying to help them get in from the rain. Will this differentiate you in every market? Yes. Will you have to earn your compensation? Yep. They're not easy conversations. They're valuable, but they're not easy. Will you likely feel a deeper sense of purpose, of value, urgency, importance, significance, uniqueness? Yeah, you will. This is what I said earlier. Some strong person is going to show them the light. And with every decent thing in them, insist, persist, and persuade them to put their problems in our hands. We owe them that. I'm strong enough to live by that conviction. I'm prayerful that you all will also take that mantle of responsibility, this oath for your clients,
whether it's on the insurance side, the retirement side, the estate side, the philanthropic side, taking this burden of responsibility and owning it. There are nights when I cannot sleep being worried about my clients being okay. It's this vow to them that has me up at night, worried about them being okay, helping get them on track. I am indebted to all of you. I am thankful for the opportunity to come and deliver this message. I am very hopeful that you will take something from this and apply it to your business. Not look at it passively in your seat, but change your practice. The packets have contact information for me. I'm not trying to recruit anybody, but if I can give you some clarification on things we've talked about, please email me or get on my calendar. Let's talk about it for 30 minutes. And John, thanks Charlotte, I think maybe not in the room, but I am very appreciative and grateful for the opportunity to be here. Thank you very much.